Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Disasters make for great headlines. They help publishers sell more newspapers and TV networks sell more ads. They generate public sympathy for charities and enable politicians to appear benevolent. But in the quiet aftermath, after the attention fades, they are simply the precursors to bigger, slower-moving disasters. Author John C. Mutter, in his new book, lays out how elites have taken advantage of natural and other disasters to consolidate greater power, leaving poor people more helpless than before. Mutter examines disasters in the Caribbean, in Myanmar, and New Orleans as case studies. He's a professor at Columbia University in the Departments of Earth and Environmental Sciences and in International and Public Affairs. He's the former deputy director of the Earth Institute and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And his book is called The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Poorer. He now joins me. Welcome to Uprising, John.
Oh, thank you. Very glad to be here.
Now, one of the things that makes your book quite unique is that you are a scientist and you've tried to study natural disasters from the perspective of social science, not just natural science. Can you explain that a bit more, why it's important to study, a social scientist, the aftermath of natural disasters?
Yes. So most of my early career, I was trained as a physicist and a mathematician, so I looked at the world that way. But if you think about what happens, for instance, after an earthquake disaster, the natural sciences aren't very helpful to you. If you want to get a sense of why the mortality, for instance, was high or why it was low, why the economy has rebounded or why it has not, the natural sciences aren't especially helpful. They're not completely unhelpful, but this is the role of the social science, to understand the social consequences of a physical paroxysm.
So, John, you say in your book that it is human nature more than nature that makes disasters so terrible. What do you mean by that?
So if you think about even where you are, a relatively small earthquake can cause a lot of mortality and a lot of social consequence, and a large one can be relatively benign. And it depends completely on how human societies react to those and prepare for them. So it takes away the natural scientist might be able to predict the magnitude of a natural event in the earth, but they can't predict the social consequences. So human nature is what is driving the social consequences.
Now, there's been this idea that societies can profit from disasters, that even if they are horribly destructive in the short term, there can be long-term benefits that arise from natural disasters, that we can make the best of a situation and improve society, and that disasters can be seen as a good opportunity. Is that actually true? Is there any evidence for this?
So the argument is that if weak, inefficient infrastructure, say bridges and schools and roads, etc., ports, airports, are destroyed or badly damaged in a natural disaster, when you rebuild it, you typically wouldn't rebuild it just as it was before. You would try to do something considerably stronger, a much broader, a much stronger bridge, for instance. And that would help commerce because it would facilitate the flow of traffic. A better port would facilitate the flow of exports and imports. So if you actually take the time and think about it and try to reconstruct using forced technology upgrades, in effect, you can come out better in the long term. The problem is that very often that isn't what happens. Everybody wants to get up and running again as quickly as possible. So there is a tendency to get back just exactly the way you were, particularly in poorer places where the prospect of having something better is not easy to see if you live in a shanty town chances are you're going to put your shanty back up again, and it's going to be very much the same.
Now, let's talk about how disasters impact poor communities much more disproportionately. The same level of an earthquake taking place in Chile in 2010 compared to Haiti in 2010 had wildly different impacts. It seems like an obvious reason why that would be the case, but let's walk through that. How poorer countries with poor infrastructure to begin with will, of course, have a much, much greater impact in terms of human disaster, human suffering.
Yeah, so part of it is fairly straightforward. If you have very little money, but you'd like to have a house, you compromise as much as you can. You try to build something within your budget, and your budget is very low. So you're also subject to exploitation because, for instance, in Haiti, many, many people will tell you there are no building codes. Well, in fact, there are building codes. They're just not enforceable because the government is weak, and there are no government institutions that can effectively enforce building codes. So people build with designs that are very poor, with materials that are very weak, and they only take a minor amount of shaking in order to fall down. Remember that the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh, the garment factory, mm-hmm. essentially fell down on its own. There was no earthquake. It just collapsed under its own weight. And most of the buildings, most of the homes in places like Haiti are ready to fall down any time. They don't take much. So naturally, the mortality will be much higher. And so in a richer country, you know, here where we are, even if the buildings are not built to be hurricane-proof or earthquake-proof by design, they'll just be better built in the first place because, you know, we have the means, we'll comply with building codes, we'll build a stronger structure just because a stronger structure is a better structure. So there's a natural way in which the poor will suffer more, both in terms of loss of property and then in loss of life. And sadly, the loss of property will not seem as if it's economically very important because the value of those capital stocks is low, denominated in dollars. You know, the house of a poor person in Haiti has probably never been evaluated. And if it was, it would be worth very little, and it wouldn't be insured, but, of course, extremely important to the person who owns it. So the losses can seem small in poor countries and very high in rich countries, but in rich countries, of course, we can cope with it. It doesn't matter so much that the losses are large. It's your ability to respond and get back on your feet that matters.
Now, you talk about in your book as the disasters having three phases. Phase mm-hmm. one is the pre-disaster, where societies are supposed to be preparing for disaster. Phase two is when the actual disaster strikes, and that's the phase that gets disproportionate media coverage, of course, because of the shock value, naturally. And then phase mm-hmm. three, which is the aftermath, where there's usually the least interest, is where you can have the worst effects set in. One would imagine, such as how Naomi Klein has showed in her book, The mm-hmm. Shock Doctrine, that capitalist enterprises, seem to take advantage of disasters to implement things like privatization, which consolidates their power. But then you also look at a country like Myanmar, where there is a military, there was during the 2008 Cyclone Nargis, there was a military junta in place there. And was the aftermath of that similar to how you see sort of corporate taking advantage of disasters?
Yes, and this surprised me. When I began thinking about this, I fully expected that Naomi Klein was right, that, you know, there's a capitalist issue here, that, you know, you're going to have capitalist elites take advantage of those situations, and that If you looked at a different part of the world with a very different sort of economic scheme, things might look quite different, but they don't. And it may simply be that there's a form of capitalism operating in Myanmar that isn't called that. But certainly they took the land away from the small farmers, consolidated into large farms, which were provided to the elite from Rangoon who had connections to the military junta. So you can write that narrative, change a few lines and a few names, and it sounds like just about anywhere else. So it's not capitalism per se. I think it's more a matter of capitalizing on situations and people in many different parts of the world, many different democratic or undemocratic schemes are able to do the same thing if there is a powerful elite frequently in government connected to business.
So let's talk about what we now need to happen and how you think the disasters should be approached from your research and from learning what you have learned. Is it just that everyone needs to, work hard to be rich or move to rich countries so that we can be protected? What are specific things that poor societies can do in phase one so that phase three of those disasters isn't so disastrous?
Right. So, in phase one, of course, protection is paramount. But I don't want to sound pessimistic, because all pessimists say they're just realists. There are acts of nature that are so extreme that nothing we can do is going to prevent them. I mean, we can't take down every building in New York and put it up again made out of titanium. There are things that are just going to be beyond us. So my concern is what happens afterwards. It's all about how to get back as quickly as you can and as reasonably as you can. And I think oversight and clear regulations about how you work after the fact is really important, because if you don't do it correctly, you'd simply set the scene for another disaster. It's a bit like not doing peace building correctly. If you don't build a sound peace, you're asking for another war. If you don't do the right thing after a disaster, you're asking for another disaster.
And let's also talk about the fact that these kinds of disasters are likely to happen more and more and more as we are experiencing severe climate change. It is happening as we speak. And the powers that be, if you will, those who have the money are preparing. They are adapting because they have the money to begin with. We see these kinds of questions that you're bringing up being raised in climate conferences. They are not taken seriously. People are attempting to organize. The question is, how can that organization be effective? Do you hope that your book will contribute to these dialogues that take place in these conferences where policies can actually get made?
Well, I hope so. let me begin with earthquakes, particularly from where you are. The earthquakes are not increasing, even though every time there is one, somebody is bound to say it seems like earthquakes are increasing. They're not. In fact, if anything, very, very long term, they should probably be decreasing. There are more people, and since a disaster is the effect on societies, effect on people, the more people there are, the more human disasters there'll be, even if there are no more earthquakes. So there's a way in which a rising population will always lead to more disasters if the physical phenomena don't change. Certainly, as climate changes, the simplest way to think of it is just that if you're heating something up, you're putting more energy in the system. So the more energy in the system, the more vigorously the system will, its dynamics will behave. So you can expect more extremes. Now, right now, the evidence for there being more extremes is not very strong, but it's reasonable theory to think that there'll be more extremes. And the fact that sea level will rise is incontestable. then your point, who is going to be able to manage under those circumstances? Well, in the same way, it'll be people who have the resources to adapt, to protect, perhaps to move. You know, maybe the place where they live will become unbearable, but they'll have the means to move somewhere else and do well in, you know, the few refuges on the planet where things are still reasonably livable. And then, you know, the rest of us will have to try to make do in more harsh situations. So what I unfortunately think might happen is that the planet we live in today, which is showing increasing inequalities, climate change is just going to exacerbate the existing inequalities.
So one of the things that we didn't get to that we should have was that even within rich countries where there are hot spots of poverty, such as in New Orleans, and where racism multiplies the effect, we see mini disasters happening, such as we did in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Doesn't ultimately the conversation that we need to be having also have to do with income equality and simply equalizing people's means and ability to live?
Yes. What happens is very often that the media concentrates first on the physical damage, then gets a bit bored with that because, you know, you can't keep showing the same fallen down buildings night after night. And then in a way that's almost lucky for the media, some sort of antisocial behavior will begin or be manufactured, some sort of looting, and the media pivots immediately to that, and that becomes a story. You know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? And of course, the people that they're worried about, what can be described as the underclass, right? They're worried about the poor people, typically black people in New Orleans, rising up against the elites and stealing things from their houses. Now, that's a form of elite panic. It's not the common people that are panicking. They're just trying to make do. But the elites start to worry about whether the common people are going to take over. And that's when the army gets called in. That's when the National Guard gets called in, not to help save people, but to save property.
Exactly. And so, yeah, there certainly needs to be a cultural shift as well. Well, John, the book, your book is called The Disaster Profiteers. And in your work as both a natural scientist and a social scientist, finally, do you have any hope for how we approach disasters? And that's, of course, a question to the social scientist hat in that you wear.
I don't think it's that difficult to introduce a sufficient measure of oversight in the post-disaster period to do things correctly and not permit social inequalities to be taken advantage of. I think there's enough history in post-war reconstructions. There should be enough history in reconstructions following financial crises, which are a little bit different. Even though the economy loses a lot of value, it doesn't lose property. Whereas in natural disasters, the loss is always in capital stock. It's buildings and roads and other sorts of infrastructure, and less in terms of the value of the overall economy.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending time discussing your book.
Well, thank you very much.
My guest is John C. Mutter. He is the author of The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Poorer.